The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine.
I heard profane words screamed at my mom or me and my siblings. I'm the middle child of three. On a daily basis, was slapped across the face because I didn't want to go across the street to ask a stranger for a cigarette, and we even got into a fist fight when I was in my 20s. Often I felt hatred toward him and wished he weren't alive. But as I got older, I became aware of his life story, a rough one, and it brought in a glimmer of clarity as to why he was the way he was. He was born in Harlem in August of 1944, didn't finish high school, and both of his parents were deceased by the time he was 14 years old. He was convinced he caused his mom's death because on the day she died, she was exasperated trying to wake him up for school. "Get up," she screamed the last time. He jumped up, hurriedly got dressed, and ran out of the house. The next thing he knew, he was being sent home to hear the tragic news. Two teenage siblings, who understandably didn't know how to parent, took over raising him and did not treat him well. At a terribly young age, he fought in Vietnam and never got over the horrors he witnessed. Both in inebriated and lucid accounts, he cried as he recollected watching a commanding officer get killed and knowing that his platoon was responsible for the deaths of civilians. "We went to the village the day before to warn them, but they didn't understand what we were saying," he cried. Well into his 60s, he was never able to recount stories about his mom or his time at war without tears welling up in his eyes. Pieces of the ice around my heart would be chiseled away when he showed this kind of vulnerability, but it wouldn't be long before the frost made a comeback because of more drunken fits and outrageous behavior. Yet when he needed something, I was the child he depended on. "I want to buy GMC stock. Can you do that for me?" he asked. When he wanted to buy a car, he took me with him and looked in my direction every time the salesman said something that he thought was BS. "I don't know," I'd say with a shrug, or, "that sounds like a lot to me." When he wanted to buy my mother gifts, he'd give me the money and say, "get her something real nice." I'd be grumpy, but I'd still help. And it was me who traveled to the hospital day and night for weeks after he went into a diabetic coma. In the wee hours, I'd make sure I was there when the shift changed so the medical staff would be well-versed on his chart. "He's not a vegetable," I told the head ICU doctor after overhearing a conversation between him and a nurse. I asked him if he knew I loved him, and he shook his head yes. Dad would eventually come out of the coma and back home, resuming his addictions. "Don't you know how lucky you are to be alive?" I'd say. I was racked with anger. Yet, I sought out a Veterans Affairs therapist and drove about an hour to take my father to his first appointment. He refused to talk. "It hurts too much," he said. Dad would inevitably end up in the hospital again, and this trip would be his last. I angrily forced him to go because he was having trouble breathing. "I'm sick," he said. "I know," I replied. "No, I'm really sick." Our eyes met for a millisecond. I think we both knew what he meant, but I pushed that awareness away, not having the mental or emotional capacity to step wholly into the meaning at that time. Huffing and puffing, I drove him to the hospital that last night, upset that more of my already zapped energy was being exerted. Mom and I wearily sat in triage, and when I glanced at Dad through the glass, he stuck his tongue out at me in jest. I was in no mood to laugh, rolled my eyes, and looked up at the NBA game on the TV screen. He was admitted, and this time I resolved that I wasn't staying. It was late, I was tired, and I had to work the next day. I told my mom I'd wait in the car until she was ready. As I sat in the darkness, I got the urge to speak to him. I called his cell phone. "Yo," he answered. "I'm sorry I was so mean tonight, Dad. It's just that you make me so angry sometimes." "I know," he said. "I'm sorry, too." "I love you, Dad." "I love you, too, baby." He died the next day. For months afterward, I dreamed about my dad. Two dreams in particular stand out. In one, he was sitting in a brown chair by a window in an empty room. I stood in front of him as he tried to apologize, but he was too emotional to say the words. "Don't worry, Dad," I interrupted. "You don't have to say it. I understand." Even in death, I was stepping in to help him. I wholeheartedly believe that my ability to express myself and take charge of difficult situations came from my continuously doing so for him. I felt that gift, and also that in life he truly was sorry for all that he'd put us through. In reality, I now held no more anger, hatred, or animosity toward him. I certainly didn't condone everything he did, but I accepted and forgave it. He spent his entire life unable to move past his circumstances, and I saw firsthand how it led to his demise. The second dream was recurring, sometimes multiple times per week. With childlike enthusiasm, Dad was clumsily running up a beautifully landscaped hill on a bright, sunny day. The dream would end just as he was out of sight. I never saw what he was so happy to run toward, but I gathered it was the recaptured joy of his youth. Before his parents' death, before Nam, before drugs. He was finally free to just be a kid again. I long for the day when I can share that joy with him that we were never able to grasp while he was alive. Until we meet again, Dad. Our next article by Katie Riley is titled, My Husband Showed Me That Love Can't Really Conquer All. When I first met Peter 12 summers ago, he was one of four people in a dive bar in San Juan del Sur, Nicaragua. He wore board shorts and flip-flops and smelled like Parliament cigarettes. He was wearing a green t-shirt that read, Thanks for looking at my shirt instead of my erection, in white block text. I was disgusted by the t-shirt, but his irreverence sparked my curiosity. I was on a brief vacation from an impossible situation. I had recently moved back home to D.C., where my mother was dying of ALS. I was helping my dad care for her. Since ALS is a terminal illness, we researched alternative treatments and shuttled her to appointments like lab rats in an experiment, searching for an exit where none existed. We watched together as she slowly lost the ability to speak, swallow, and eventually breathe. I stared at the tattoos that poked out from the edges of Peter's sleeves. He said he hated it when people asked him the significance of each tattoo. All I could hear was the way he pronounced my name in his Irish accent. I asked anyway. Every old man I see reminds me of my father, Peter translated from Irish Gaelic to English, a poem by Patrick Kavanagh tattooed on his right arm. Peter had the answers I would soon need about how to survive the death of someone you love. His dad had died a year prior from pancreatic cancer, and his brother died by suicide just days before Peter's 18th birthday. Within hours of meeting, I shared details with him that I had not shared with anyone else. And although he was a stranger, home quickly became wherever he was. Against all logic, when my mother died 4 months later, the only person I wanted to tell about the pain of her sickness and death was the Irish guy I'd met at a bar in San Juan del Sur. Peter became my long-distance boyfriend, and when I brought him my sadness, he never changed the conversation or tried to escape. He just listened. A year and a half after my mother died, my father was diagnosed with cancer. Dad survived the first round of chemotherapy, but the cancer returned less than 2 years after remission. Within months, he was in the emergency room. Peter spent as much time at the hospital as I did. After almost 2 weeks in the ICU, my father died the very night he seemed to stabilize. Peter and I married months later, and we left the East Coast for the California sunshine in my dad's green Jeep that I inherited. Mom and Dad are coming with us, I joked to Peter as my parents' ashes sat perched between the two front seats. It was a strange arrangement for newlyweds, but Peter never questioned it. We slowly made our way, stopping in Roanoke, Nashville, Oklahoma City, the Grand Canyon, Zion National Park, and Santa Fe, and Mom and Dad were there too. They stayed in La Quinta hotels, ate Subway, listened to live music, and had beers at dive bars. So many people told me I was lucky to have love at such a hard time. We are told a lot of things about love. We are told that it can heal anything. As we drove across the country, I wanted to believe that myth. I wanted a new start and to outrun grief. When my mother died, the pain was enormous, but so was my hope that my life could only improve with increasing space from illness and death, and more room to give our relationship a chance. Who knows what would have happened to me in my grief for my mother if that had been my only loss? All I know is that when my father died, the wheels came off. I'd hoped that somehow my grief would remain invisible, undetectable, and wouldn't interfere with our new life together. But like the ashes between us on the road trip, my grief followed us everywhere we went. Throughout our trip, I obsessed over the ashes. I checked in on them often, like a plant or a pet, to assure myself they were okay. They were the first pieces of luggage that I brought into our room wherever we stayed, fearing they could get lost or stolen. When we got across the country, my grief took up all the room in our apartment. And so despite my love for Peter, he was often on the receiving end of my anger. I snapped at him when he forgot something at the store or forgot to put new toilet paper on the roll. I wrote him about prompt email responses, our taxes, or leaving the gas tank empty. I snapped and we fought and we repeated that cycle until we couldn't anymore. In the year or two following my father's death, we hurt each other so much that we would spend the following years detangling it. I hated who I had become, so I assume Peter felt the same. I tried to be normal because I thought that was the version of me Peter wanted. He never requested that of me, but I assumed it when he named my anxiety or showed frustration when I didn't want to leave the apartment again. Since all my emotional chips were on Peter, I feared losing him too in a million different ways. I cried when he couldn't quit smoking, convinced cigarettes would kill him. I worried that he couldn't endure living with my grief forever. Despite my fears, he never wavered in his loyalty to me. "I can't carry the weight of your sadness anymore," Peter said one day in our San Francisco apartment. Although he had told me this multiple times before, it was the first time the words sunk in. I'm not sure why I heard Peter that day. Perhaps it was that enough time had passed since my parents' deaths, or maybe it was the sadness in his eyes. I loved Peter so much that I wanted to believe that alone was enough to take away the sadness of losing my parents, but it couldn't. I'm not sure any love can. Only I could heal my grief, and I finally understood that I needed to begin to learn how. That conversation was a start of sloth speed change in our relationship. There was never a switch that flipped as much as I searched for it. We just kept trying. We went to couples therapy. We moved out of the city. I left a job I hated. I started therapy on my own. We did couples therapy again. I journaled. I cried. I found a new therapist again. I ran countless miles. I drank too many glasses of wine. I screamed into my pillow. I meditated. I grieved. And in that morning, I found pieces of a new version of myself that I loved, and I made tiny steps back to Peter. Our relationship in many ways looks like it did years ago. We still share our grief, but it is not the only thing we share. I know that it never was. We speak to each other with honesty and with vulnerability. We still go to the gym together, enjoy outdoor concerts, and tease each other to show affection. Now we are parents to two small girls, and we try to find time to spend alone together. On a recent date night, we sat on a restaurant deck overlooking a San Francisco sunset. "I miss your dad," Peter said, teary-eyed. "I wish he could see the family we've created together." My eyes watered as we locked eyes. "I miss him too," I replied and smiled. In that moment, I knew Peter saw me, that he'd seen me all along. He saw me as a person capable of carrying many things, a person with whom he could share not only the weight of grief, but also his love. And for that, I'm very grateful. Our next article by Svetlana Kiddo is titled, "They Left Careers in the Arts for the Field of Nursing." The early months of the COVID-19 pandemic were a frightening time. Some lost friends and loved ones. Some found themselves in unwilling solitude while others thought they'd never have a moment alone again. People lost their jobs while still a great number were forced to work at the risk of getting sick. In New York City, the din of ambulance sirens would not let up, a constant reminder of untold suffering. Amid all this darkness and uncertainty, a small window of hope opened every day at 5 p.m. when, in many cities, people banged on pots and pans to give thanks for the superheroes of our new reality, healthcare workers. In our first story for the Pivot column, we celebrate a crop of recent nursing school graduates, newly anointed heroes for the COVID-19 era. Though we are experiencing an ongoing nursing shortage, with a recent report showing that 30% of nurses are still considering leaving the profession, the pandemic has been a catalyst for some to pick up a stethoscope. CUE Columbia University's nursing program, which has seen an uptick in admissions since the pandemic began. Within the first 6 months of the pandemic, we were astounded to receive a 30% increase in applications. The phones were ringing off the hook, says Judy Wolf, Senior Associate Dean of Student Affairs at Columbia School of Nursing. Founded in 1892, the Columbia School of Nursing was actually designed with second career hopefuls in mind. In 1990, nearly 100 years later, the school introduced its innovative accelerated program, guaranteeing a Master of Science in 15 months. To promote diversity, the program has adopted a new holistic admissions process. This means focusing less on academic records and more on who potential students are, where they come from, and what they value, as well as evidence that they care passionately about vulnerable populations. According to Wolf, the idea of nurses just being for bedside or bedtime care is long expired. In recent years, you'll see that nursing has exploded in local areas, government, education, corporate, it's everywhere. That's why we need people with different skill sets and life experiences. Here, two recent grads and a current student of Columbia's nursing program talk about finding the courage to become a newbie in a totally new career field and what they learned along the way. From the time she was 16 years old, Avra Messi knew she wanted to be a ceramic artist. At 17, she went to one of the country's best undergrad programs for ceramics, followed by a top-tier grad school. By the time she was 23 years old, she was a professor in her field. But after more than 25 years of working in the art world, she decided it was time to pursue the road not taken. She currently works as a nurse in an oncology unit and is in school full-time getting her doctorate to become a nurse practitioner. I will just say this about the art world. It's very misogynistic. I experienced it my entire career. In undergrad, one of my professors would have polls about which girls were the best looking. When I became a professor, my school always supported the male grads over the women. The galleries were more likely to show male work. I also found it very hard to get back into the art world after I had children. I finally took a job at a lamp company where I made all the glazes and surfaces for the product. When it was time for me to get promoted, they gave it to a 23-year-old guy with no experience. Every day I would come home so miserable from that job. That summer, my wife and I took a road trip to Maine, which turned out to be a long drive with no cell service. So we started playing games. She asked me, "What would you do if you couldn't be an artist?" I've always been interested in medicine. Most of my sculptures reference internal organs and medical devices. I said, "I'd love to be a nurse." By September 1st, I was taking prereqs. I graduated from the Columbia Nursing Program in 2020. 3 days after Columbia got its first COVID case, the university shut down and went remote. Columbia worked out a system with New York Presbyterian for students to work as nurse techs. I learned to wrap bodies immediately. It was just devastating. A death every single day. But I got to feel like I was part of the solution during this global pandemic. I know it's not the voice that you usually hear, but I found it very exciting. I absolutely hit the ground running. I think everyone should do a midlife career change. It's invigorating. I'm excited about my future in this field and so grateful to be a part of it. I really love it. I know there's a lot of burnout in this profession because there's short staffing up the wazoo, but I'm still untouched by it. My batteries are fully charged. By the time Tristan Kim had left college in Korea, where he studied French, Japanese, and theater, he had already been cast in many short films, commercials, and TV shows. Kim's work took him to Thailand, where he was part of a K-pop group, which led to an offer to host MTV Thailand. Kim rejected the offer and moved to Hollywood to pursue acting. When the pandemic hit and everything, including the entertainment industry, was put on pause, Kim went from being a performing actor to enrolling at Columbia for nursing. During the pandemic, I was working at a Japanese restaurant where the staff were like my second family. When the restaurant shut down, there was a sense that we were going through the devastation together. And of course, there was government help. I decided that I needed some financial stability in my life. My dad is an ophthalmologist, and my grandma used to be a pediatrician. I grew up watching them. I think their dedication to helping people really affected me. I had never thought I would get into Columbia Nursing School. I didn't know English up until pretty recently. I worked really, really hard. I remember being very emotional when I got the acceptance letter. My training as an actor has helped me a lot with the nursing program. As actors, we are taught to go deep into our own psychology, understand ourselves, which translates well into understanding others. The more I know myself, the more I can help you. One example is my ability to read nonverbal cues. A patient might say their pain is a 3 out of a 10. I look for other cues, grimaces on the face, or maybe the patient is trembling. That kind of indicates that this patient is in much more pain than they are saying. I love nursing, but I'm not trying to get away from acting. I just don't know when my break is going to come. When I have an acting hiatus, I want to focus on nursing. If I do book something, maybe I can take a leave of absence for a little bit. I want to hold on to both professions because I think both are very beautiful. Danny Burgos was on tour with a Broadway musical called The Band's Visit when the pandemic hit and his whole life changed. When the show had to shut down in Pittsburgh, Burgos moved back in with his family in Miami. Before getting swept up in the bright lights of musical theater, he had wanted to be a nurse, so he made the leap. In May 2022, he gave the commencement speech at his graduation from the Columbia Nursing Program and now plans on working in community medicine with an emphasis on LGBTQ+ inclusive care. My story starts in 2009 when I graduated high school. I wanted to be a nurse, but I took one anatomy and physiology class in college and it just killed my spirits. I switched my major to musical theater, which had always been really easy for me. Straight out of college, I booked a national tour of Beauty and the Beast, then regional productions of In the Heights. In 2016, I booked On Your Feet, my first Broadway show, then I got The Band's Visit. If you look at my resume, I'm always the understudy to the lead. I became very negative. I kept getting so close to Broadway, they always went with the other guy. I kept telling my friends, I think this is my last show. And then we got to Pittsburgh at the peak of the pandemic. Pretty soon we were all out of a job. I ended up moving back to Miami at 30 years old, living in my childhood bedroom. Remember how back in the beginning people were banging pots and pans outside their windows for healthcare workers? That was what first got me thinking. I woke up one morning and decided I was going to finish what I started and take prereqs for nursing. I got to anatomy and physiology, the classes that had broken me, and I got through them. It was really fantastic, so I started applying to schools. Nothing about life is linear. You have to just go where your heart takes you. Like we say in acting, go before you're ready. You're never going to be ready to make a huge life change. You just slowly but surely do it. And then you look back and it's a year and a half later and you're a nurse. Our next article by Grant Ridner is titled 20 Famous Hispanic People Who Are Killing It in 2022. National Hispanic Heritage Month begins September 15th and ends on October 15th, 2022. It's a special time dedicated to celebrating the positive influences of Hispanic and Latin American culture on our society. Many of those contributions would not have been possible without famous Hispanic people, and women in particular. Alongside those more established names are a slew of rising figures in the worlds of film, politics, and literature, telling important Latinx and Afro-Latina stories and championing diversity in gender, sexuality, and ethnicity. Ahead, a look at just a few of the badass Latina and Hispanic women who are making a splash in 2022. India Moore. Moore, who is of Puerto Rican and Dominican descent and identifies as Afro-Taino, was the breakout star of FX's Pose. But in addition to being a model and actor, they were featured on the Time 100 list in 2019 for their work as a transgender activist and leading voice speaking in support of marginalized communities. Rita Moreno. Did you know that Rita Moreno is the only Latinx actress with an EGOT, Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony under her belt? And her accolades don't stop there. In 2019, the Puerto Rican actress also became the first Latinx performer to earn a Peabody Career Achievement Award. In addition to starring in the West Side Story remake, Moreno continued to reprise her role in the former Netflix-turned-pop TV series One Day at a Time, which came to an end in 2020 after its fourth season. Jennifer Lopez. Where do we even begin with Jennifer Lopez? After nearly three decades in show business, the Puerto Rican A-lister captured the world's attention with her Super Bowl halftime show in 2020. Her starring turn in Hustlers, a crime comedy drama based on a true story of a group of strippers who embezzled money from wealthy clients, earned rave reviews, albeit no Oscar nomination. Up next, she has The Godmother, a hard-edged biopic of drug lord Griselda Blanco. Mariah Carey. Carey, whose mother is Irish-American while her father was Black and Venezuelan, is the iconic diva who has long cemented herself as a musical legend. In addition to classic albums like Music Box, Butterfly, and The Emancipation of Mimi, Carey's incomparable voice has earned her 19 number one songs on Billboard's Hot 100, 5 Grammys, 10 American Music Awards, and 19 World Music Awards. In 2020, she published her revealing memoir, The Meaning of Mariah Carey, in collaboration with journalist Michaela Angela Davis. Sonia Sotomayor. When former President Barack Obama appointed Sonia Sotomayor to the Supreme Court of the United States, she became the first Hispanic and Latina justice. When she isn't making impassioned dissents on issues of race, ethnic identity, gender, and much more on the country's highest court, she's writing children's books. In her 2019 book, Just Ask, Be Different, Be Brave, Be You, Sotomayor introduces readers to children who face several life challenges as they work together to create a garden of different flowers and plants. Alexis Bledel. Though Bledel is known by Gilmore Girls superfans as Rory, Bledel, whose father was born and raised in Argentina and mother was raised in Mexico, stars as Emily on the hit Hulu series The Handmaid's Tale. Soon, she'll be serving us some more much-needed nostalgia with Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants 3. Rosalía. If you don't know the name Rosalía yet, allow us to introduce you. The rising Spanish singer was nominated for Best New Artist at the 2020 Grammys and took home Best Latin Rock, Urban, or Alternative Album for El Mal Caer. Lately, she's been tearing up the charts with songs like La Fama with The Weeknd and Candy. Fun fact, she was also the only musician featured in Time Magazine's Next Generation Leaders in 2019. Camila Cabello. In 2019, Camila Cabello scored a huge hit with Señorita featuring Shawn Mendes, which climbed to the number one position on the Billboard Hot 100. She released her sophomore album, Romance, in December 2019, scoring hits like the platinum-certified My Oh My. She's one of the most omnipresent pop stars around today. Cardi B. Cardi B became a household name following the release of her commercial debut single, Bodak Yellow. On September 25, 2017, the song reached the number one spot, making Cardi the first female rapper to do so with a solo single since Lauryn Hill's doo-wop, That Thing, in 1998. She also became the first person of Dominican descent to reach number one in the history of the Hot 100 since it launched in 1958. Cardi made her film debut alongside Jennifer Lopez and Constance Wu in Hustlers and had a brief role in the action blockbuster F9. Eva Longoria. It's been a busy few years for Eva Longoria. The mother of four-year-old Santiago stepped into the role of executive producer and cast member on the ABC series Grand Hotel. Plus, she starred in the live-action Door and the Lost City of Gold alongside Isabella Moner, Eugenio Derbez, Michael Pena, and Danny Trejo. Oh, and in her free time, Longoria, who has directed episodes of series like Blackish and Jane the Virgin, says she has many more plans to work behind the camera and is directing and starring in the upcoming film 24/7. Ms. Rodriguez. Rodriguez found success via Ryan Murphy's groundbreaking drama Pose, which wrapped its third and final season last year. The series also earned the star a platform as a passionate trans activist, with Advocate naming her one of their Women of the Year in 2020. Now Rodriguez is moving on to her musical career under the name Michaela Jay and stars in the Apple TV Plus comedy series Loot alongside Maya Rudolph. Daniela Vega. Chilean actress Daniela Vega delivered a stunning performance in the Oscar-nominated A Fantastic Woman, and though she has been relatively quiet since the film's release in 2018, her impact continues to ripple. She was on Time 100's Most Influential People list and became the first transgender person to present at the Academy Awards. Vega's role in Un Domingo de Julio en Santiago is another show-stopping turn. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Often referred to by her initials, AOC, Ocasio-Cortez made history when she became the youngest woman ever to serve in the United States Congress at 29. Since being elected in 2018, the Puerto Rican Bronx native has continued to make headlines thanks to her Green New Deal and outspoken commentary on social media. She handily won re-election in the Democratic primary, ensuring she'll remain a fixture in local and national politics. Carmen Maria Machado. Writer Carmen Maria Machado is one of the most acclaimed young names in sci-fi and horror fiction, with the 2017 collection Her Body and Other Parties winning numerous awards and rave reviews. With a penchant for subverting genre tropes and an ability to integrate heavy real-world subject matter, 2019's In the Dream House chronicles an abusive relationship she endured, Machado is sure to continue breaking boundaries for queer authors. Sofia Vergara. Since Sofia Vergara started playing the role of Gloria Delgado Pritchett on Modern Family in 2009, she's been nominated for 4 Golden Globes, 4 Emmys, and 7 SAG Awards. The role, along with a slew of endorsement and licensing deals, landed the Colombian actress at the top of the list of highest-paid TV actresses in 2019 for the 8th year in a row. Following the end of Modern Family, the sitcom enjoyed a record-breaking run with 250 episodes. Vergara lent her unmistakable voice to the animated film Coati. Shakira. As one of the world's best-selling music artists, Shakira is always looking for ways to stay connected to her fans. When she's not sharing pictures of her kids or making history with Jennifer Lopez during the Super Bowl halftime show, the Colombian singer is, well, quite literally taking over the world. The 2018 El Dorado World Tour was the first time she toured in the U.S. in 7 years, and to celebrate the milestone, she released a concert film in theaters. Julia Salazar. Along with AOC, 31-year-old New York State Senator Julia Salazar is part of a progressive wave of young women in politics fighting for a more equitable world. She is a champion for sex worker rights, immigration, and criminal justice reform, and serves as chair of New York's Committee on Women's Health. Winning her last primary in Brooklyn's District 18 with nearly 84% of the vote, Salazar may well become a figure on the national scene soon enough. Mariali Rivas. Chilean filmmaker Rivas has been an indie cinema darling since the release of 2012's Young and Wild and continues to tell critical and underreported stories. Young and Wild focused on a bisexual teenager growing up in a conservative Protestant family, while her latest, Princess Sita, explores a young girl's life in a cult of toxic masculinity. Tessa Thompson. Born to an Afro-Panamanian father and mother of Mexican ancestry, Tessa Thompson has become not just a bankable box office draw in films like Thor, Ragnarok, and Creed, but a daring actress capable of incredibly moving, tender performances. More recently, she starred in the romantic drama Sylvie's Love and the scintillating thriller Passing, as well as a continued role on Westworld. Julia Alvarez. In 2020, Julia Alvarez returned to adult fiction after a 16-year hiatus, penning the dazzling Afterlife. And if that gets you hooked, she has a vast bibliography of nonfiction, books for young readers, poetry, and picture books, as she is one of the most prolific authors of the past few decades. Our next article, by Cassie Hurwitz, is titled Living Her Best Life: Allison Felix on Supporting Female Athletes and Working Moms. One can imagine that after winning 11 Olympic medals and becoming the most decorated woman in Olympic track and field history, your ego might be a little inflated. Yet Allison Felix, the holder of that title, appears just as down-to-earth as anyone who hasn't beaten one of Usain Bolt's records. Yep, she's done that too. Felix is as steady as they come, exuding a calm confidence through it all. Emails with Oprah Daily, her final run at the U.S. Championship, and playing with her daughter, Cammie. After dedicating over two decades of her life to the sport, Felix is ready for the next step, giving back to the community that served her for so long. She's been a longtime advocate for women's equality in sports, especially for mom athletes in recent years, but with her impending retirement from racing, Felix is speeding up those efforts. That means partnerships with organizations like Athleta and Voice in Sport, all of which are geared towards supporting a new generation of women and girls, particularly athletes. She also started her own company, Saish, to zero in on this cause. Lucky for us, Felix took a break from dismantling the patriarchy to share what she's up to, from spending time with her daughter to the music she listens to when it's time to warm up for a race. Her time management. For me, living my best life means family time with my husband and daughter. With my schedule, it's difficult to find time for myself, but as I near the end of my racing career, I'm excited to have the opportunity to dive into some of the books that have been on my list. It will be a nice break from all the children's books we read with Cammie. I'm also watching more Coco Melon than you might think. It's one of Cammie's favorites. Her dedication to women's empowerment. Right now, I'm listening to a lot of Lizzo and Beyonce, especially these days when I'm warming up and getting into my zone. As my racing career comes to a close, I am learning to change my mindset that each race is not just about finishing first. To me, this season is more about what I am leaving behind for my fellow female athletes and for my daughter. I'm using this season to raise awareness for a critically important issue facing all moms, starting with mom athletes, to show how industries need to support women holistically in every facet of their lives, including childcare. It's bittersweet to be in my last season, and I am trying to focus on not only putting my best foot forward on the track, but looking beyond at the impact we can make together. Her hopes for the future. I am learning more about how to use my platform to make an impact on issues that are close to my heart, particularly around supporting women and moms who are pursuing their professional goals while raising a family. I've always been an advocate in this realm, so I have learned to align myself with brands and organizations that share my values of empowering women and girls in all facets of life. I've created Saish, a community-centered footwear brand made for and by women, to provide support to women in a meaningful way. Her next phase. I am also working with Athleta and the nonprofit organization And Mother to create a more equitable world for mom athletes on and off the track. One of the ways we are doing this is by offering free accessible childcare through Vivi for athletes, coaches, and staff participating in select USATF events. Thinking of it like a toolkit of solutions that other professional sports organizations can take and apply to support their female athletes and their children. Ultimately, we hope that this work can be used to inform leaders from across any industry to provide better support and dismantle inequities for working moms. I am also working with Athleta's Power of She Fund and Women's Sports Foundation to award the next round of child care grants to help fund the cost for professional mom athletes traveling to competitions. Recently, I also launched the Maternity Returns program through SAISH. Through this program, expectant mothers can feel good about their purchases for shoes despite any changes to their foot size that may occur during pregnancy. SAISH was founded to address inequities for women in the world of athletics, and this is one way we are ensuring that women are supported in every stage of their professional and personal lives. I am excited to lean into my what's next while continuing to be an advocate for women and moms. I honestly feel the possibilities are endless, and I'm so excited for what's to come. This interview has been edited and condensed for clarity. Our next article by Francine Maroukian is titled, "These High-Quality Spices Are the Secret to Great Home Cooking." In the days when I interviewed chefs for a food column, I often wrapped up our conversations by asking, "Can you tell me just one thing that will make me a better cook right now?" Looking back, the simplest answer I got also turned out to be most elusive. "Buy better spices," one chef told me. Although I thought I knew what he meant, it took a global pandemic before I came to a full understanding of his advice. At first, I assumed the directive was as simple as price, pay more. I stopped shopping for cheap, mass-produced spices at conventional supermarkets and started buying premium spices from specialty stores. But that was only part of what he meant. The advice didn't fully blossom until COVID's empty market shelves sent me to online resources, and my first encounter with spices of much greater quality than I had ever used. Once I started cooking with them, the difference in aroma and flavor was shocking. And friends, I've been at this a long, long time. I have not looked back. One of my delightful finds was Burlap and Barrel, a spice company known for its sustainable sourcing practices. They only buy directly, and I mean directly, from farms with equitable and safe work environments. According to co-founder Ori Zohar, most of Burlap's first-time COVID-era shoppers, like me, have coalesced into a loyal following, and I'm part of it. In my kitchen, herbs have always been a part of everyday cooking, maybe because they grow in backyards, even windowsills, and are available fresh year-round. But spices, grown in tropical and subtropical zones, always seemed exotic, delivering flavors more foreign than familiar. "Not the case," explained Zohar, who was born in Israel and raised in Baltimore, which happens to be home to America's most famous spice mix, Old Bay. Historically, American home cooking has always reflected a variety of global influences, and spices have always been part of our kitchens. What's new is the attention we're starting to pay to how our spices are grown. We want better quality products across our pantries. We want a connection to the origin of these products. That connection isn't traceable when we buy mass-produced spices. Stockpiling the huge quantities of spices required to fill supermarket shelves can require sourcing from many different growers and even multiple countries. Those supermarket jars might be filled with stuff that came together without any record of how or where the individual shipments were grown. Are they from regions where harmful environmental practices are used? Pesticides? What are the labor conditions for the workers at the different growing locations? In addition, artificial colors and flavors or chemical fillers may be added to bulk up the spice supply. This unidentified, unspecific spice mix then passes through many stages of processing and distribution, what Zohar calls the black hole, which can take years. By the time those jars land in our shopping carts, the potential of all the qualities that make spices so special, their intoxicating aroma, genuine flavor, and even the health benefits that can range from improving digestion to boosting metabolism, can be irreparably damaged, gone even. What sets Burlap and Barrel apart from this mass-produced hodgepodge is a commitment to single-origin spices. They can be traced back to a specific farm or farmer cooperative, which Zohar and his co-founder, Ethan Frisch, then visit. By spending time on the ground with our partner farmers and working with total transparency, we can also tell our customers the honest story behind our spices, explaining how and where they grow and who works on the farms where we go to source, says Zohar. For us, the goal is to change the culture of thinking about spices. We want you to consider them as something more than colorful ground powders. I finally understand the advice that chef gave me years ago. It wasn't just about spending more money, although I do now. It was about value. He meant I should purchase spices of authenticity as well as accountability, buying from sources where sustainability and credibility principles aren't buzzwords but concrete practices. I've come to respect the power of cooking this way. I mean, I thought my gumbo was great before. How to use herbs and spices. Although herbs and spices are often grouped together, they're actually very different cooking components with one basic similarity. Both come from aromatic botanicals. Herbs are the leaves, stems, and flowers, generally soft in texture like basil or slightly woody like rosemary, of plants found in temperate climates. Spices are the bark, roots, seeds, buds, and berries, generally hard like peppercorns or cinnamon, from tropical and subtropical zones. Whether a recipe calls for herbs or spices or how it combines them can provide a history lesson that links the origin of a dish to its community roots. For example, those distinctive dishes of New Orleans, gumbo and jambalaya, contain a long list of herbs and spices reflecting the cultural mix of Spanish and French colonists with the large enslaved Afro-Caribbean population. The great dissimilarity between spices and herbs is in the manner and timing of their usage, which comes down to one thing, heat. Spices like it, herbs don't. Here is a wonderful tutorial from Burlap and Barrel about all kinds of ways to use spices, and here are my tips. Herbs. Because their essential oils are diminished by heat, I often add my fresh chopped herbs toward the end of cooking time as a way of balancing flavor. When hardier stems of herbs are used early in the cooking process, like stalks of rosemary and sprigs of thyme in making stock or a braising liquid, I discard them after they lend their essential oil to the liquid and add freshly chopped right before serving. Spices. Because they are typically hard in texture, spices require heat and moisture to release their essential oils. They are introduced early in the cooking process, playing more of an integral role in flavor development. When I immerse whole spices in cooking liquid, for example, whole cloves, allspice, and peppercorns in a braise or shrimp boil, I place them in a small square of cheesecloth, draw the edges together to form a bag, loosely tie it with kitchen twine, or use a small pre-made spice bag available in any cookware store, and place it on a clean work surface. Using the side of a knife blade, I press down on the bag and crack open the surfaces of the whole spice without grinding, and allow maximum flavor to be released as the liquid heats. At the end of the cooking time, it is easy to remove the bag and continue with the recipe. When using ground spices, say in a chili or a stew, I sprinkle the mixture over the aromatic vegetables, like the garlic and onions, as they are being sautéed, cooking the spices as a way of intensifying their flavor before additional liquid is added. This process requires frequent stirring to prevent the spices from burning, but the result is worth it because the heat brings out the toasty flavor of the spices and gives the finished dish much more color and depth. Our next article by Brittany Leitner is titled Health Benefits of Taking a Morning Walk. For many, going on a walk in the morning can be an instant way to boost your mood. Medical facts aside, just think about it. When you walk outside, you'll be exposed to the sunshine, and that little dose of vitamin D will help you instantly feel more awake. Not only will you get your blood pumping, but you'll also be able to take in everything your local neighborhood or wherever you're walking has to offer. It can also be a time when you can let go of whatever's stressing you out and focus on what you are hoping to accomplish that day. Noticing the trees, the new coffee shop on the corner, or even the outfits of the people you come across can all help you feel present. And it doesn't hurt to blast your favorite tunes while you do it either. But walking isn't just good for your mind, it's also good for your body. Because it's a low-impact activity, just about anyone at any physical skill level or age can do it without training or having any prior experience. Since it's easy on the body, many people feel like they're not working out at all when they take a walk, but the opposite is true. According to the Mayo Clinic, walking can help your heart stay healthy by preventing and managing conditions like heart disease and stroke. Additionally, it can even help certain individuals lose weight, according to Harvard Medical School. If you're concerned about recent or past health issues, consult with your doctor before starting a routine walking endeavor. But if you're up to the challenge, we ask the experts to share ways that taking a morning walk can benefit you. Improve cardiovascular health and circulation. An hour or so before you wake up, your body starts to get ready for the day, says Manuel Flores, MD, who is also the Dean and Vice President of Academics of the University of Health Sciences, Antigua. At this time, your blood pressure starts to go up as well as your pulse, and your endocrine glands start to secrete larger amounts of hormones to get your body ready, including thyroid hormone, also called thyroxine. This is where the routine of a morning walk comes in. By walking every morning, you reduce this increase in blood pressure and heart rate, therefore improving your cardiovascular health, Flora says. Improve the body's ability to use oxygen and breathe. A morning walk can be good for the soul and for your lungs. As long as you have your doctor's approval, morning walks are a great benefit for individuals with pulmonary disease, such as chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD, says Sherry Tooley, the 2021-2022 president and CEO of the American Association for Respiratory Care. Walking is a low-impact activity, and it can improve the body's ability to use oxygen, she adds. In fact, according to a 2016 study published in the Journal of COPD Foundation, patients who walked at least 60 minutes per day reduced their COPD rehospitalization rate by 50%, with 5,000 steps being the target objective. Positively impact your health long term. There's no limit to how walking daily can help improve your physical health. Flores recommends walking at least 150 minutes per week, and Tooley agrees, suggesting 30 minutes per day. Daily walks help you prevent or manage various health conditions, improve cardiovascular fitness, boost your mood, reduce stress, and more, including enhancing your metabolism, says Tooley. These benefits can all support your respiratory health as well. Heart health and lung health go hand in hand, so as long as your doctor okays you for this activity, walking provides tremendous health benefits. Lower stress and boost your mood. Both Flores and Tooley agree that walking can help clear your mind and help boost your mood. According to a 2020 study published in the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health, respondents who took regular walks or engaged in other forms of physical exercise had better emotional health than those who did not exercise regularly. Reduce your Alzheimer's risk. Morning walks also strengthen your muscles, clear your mind, improve mental health, and reduce risk of developing Alzheimer's disease, says Flores. In fact, in a 2020 Alzheimer's review, researchers found that a prospective study of more than 8 years showed that women who walked more had less cognitive decline during the entire study period. Lower your risk of catching infections like COVID-19. We all want to make sure we're making healthy choices to combat the ever-present threat of infections like COVID-19, and walking is a simple way to do so, according to our experts. Walking daily boosts the immune function and can reduce the risk of catching infectious diseases, says Flores. Lower your blood pressure. The heart-healthy benefits of regular walking continue. Because your heart rate goes up during a walk, even if you feel like it's not, it can directly help lower your blood pressure, according to Flores. Starting your day with a walk adds to the beneficial power. Kicking your walk off in the morning shortly after you wake up gives you the opportunity to take advantage of these benefits throughout the day, adds Tooley. Have fewer sick days per year. That's right, this morning routine staple can reduce the number of sick days you have throughout the year. Studies have shown that people who walk at least 150 minutes per week have around 40% fewer sick days, says Flores. That means you'll have more time for doing the things you love instead of spending your days cooped up at home with cold meds. We'll end this week with a message from Oprah. I want to ask you this question. How do you usually feel by Sunday? Happy for a day to rest and calmly reset for the week? Or are you so tired that all you can do is just kind of collapse? Or is it just like every other day for you, packed with places to go, a bunch of chores, and maybe even answering and sending Slacks and emails to get a head start on the work week? Well, if your life is so busy that the only time you pause is when you just can't go any longer, when your tank is completely empty, then you need to readjust and find the right balance of rest for you. Taking a pause when you need to is a gift to yourself, and unless you do that, you're headed straight for burning out. If you're nodding your head right now because this hits close to home, I want you to know that there is value in moderation. You don't have to be doing the most to be your best. In fact, it's impossible to always be your best when you're always doing the most with no time to rest, relax, and reflect. So, insiders, this week I want you to really become aware of the places in your life where you are spreading yourself too thinly. Instead, concentrate on the one or two things you'd like to do that create a space that will be of service to you and others, rather than overextending yourself to the point of exhaustion. I'd love to hear in the comments how you're choosing to pare down a little bit this week. Like my mentor Maya Angelou told me in one of the last interviews I did with her, everything in moderation. Even moderation in moderation. Go well. Instead, concentrate on the one or two things you'd like to do that create a space that will be of service to you and others, rather than overextending yourself to the point of exhaustion. I'd love to hear in the comments how you're choosing to pare down a little bit this week. Like my mentor Maya Angelou told me in one of the last interviews I did with her, everything in moderation. Even moderation in moderation. Go well. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.